We're talking about federal OSHA documents shedding light on the Husky Energy explosion and fire that rocked the Twin Ports in April 2018, injuring dozens of refinery workers. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In December of 2019, the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, the federal agency investigating the explosion and fire at the Superior Refinery, they released a five-minute animation of what went very wrong.
At approximately 10 a.m., the hazardous mixture of air and hydrocarbons found an ignition source, and there was a large explosion. Debris from the explosion flew about 200 feet and hit a large above-ground storage tank, puncturing the side of the tank and releasing hot asphalt.
Join in on what you remember from the dark plume of smoke, what you wonder about federal investigators and the status of the refinery today, 800-642-1234. Danielle Kading is a reporter in Wisconsin Public Radio's Superior Bureau. Danny, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning. So tell us about these documents WPR obtained from OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration.
Yeah, so these documents show that the refinery was aware of erosion with a piece of equipment that's known as a spent catalyst slide valve, and that prevents air and hydrocarbons from mixing as part of the refining process. And there were holes on this valve that were found during the refinery's two past shutdowns that they did to conduct maintenance back in 2008 and 2013. And they said that the refinery should have inspected the valve more frequently than its five-year timeline for repair and replacement of mechanical equipment during these shutdowns. And they and refinery workers knew that this valve was malfunctioning in the days leading up to the explosion. And there are some other findings that were surprising to OSHA inspectors. And I can go into more of that if you like.
I'm wondering though, did what you found in these documents match up to what Husky Energy, the owner then, had told the public, had told people about the explosion and fire?
Well, Husky has said since the beginning that they were going to investigate the root cause of the incident, that they had their own internal investigation, and that they were fully cooperating with the Chemical Safety Board, the Environmental Protection Agency, OSHA, and any other state or federal agencies that might have been involved. You know, they have not said anything about what they believe caused the explosion. They have been kind of relying on what these agencies have been revealing and haven't revealed or released, to my knowledge, any details of what they have found in their internal inspection.
It seems like it's, you know, over 4 years now. Shouldn't we be further along in knowing the root causes and knowing exactly where to go from here?
Yeah, I do think there's a lot of frustration about the time that it's taken to get to the bottom of what exactly happened. You know, OSHA released its findings of workplace safety violations from this explosion back in 2018. And that came out, I think it was in October, and the explosion had happened in April. But we still don't know what the final report from the Chemical Safety Board has to say about the root causes that led to this incident. They have been plagued by a backlog of investigations and a shortage of staff that have prevented them from moving through the cases that they're investigating. And as you know, there are new incidents that are occurring every year across the country. And so this has been pushed further back down the timeline. And right now it looks like next year is their latest update on when we might know the final details of what they have seen. Mm-hmm. But they've said that before, that, you know, they expected back in 2019, I believe, to release their final findings. So it's been a lot of just pushing it down the line.
And I'm wondering, I want to make sure I understand the difference here, because the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, their independent, non-regulatory federal agency investigating causes of major chemical incidents. We heard that clip from their video animation of the malfunction earlier. So how does their investigation differ from what OSHA is looking into?
Yeah, so like you said, you know, they're an independent federal agency and they look at the root cause of chemical accidents, where OSHA looks primarily at worker safety. So okay. They're focusing on that aspect. So where they deviate is that, you know, the CSB might look into things like equipment failures, unforeseen chemical reactions or other hazards. And there's also a difference too, in that they don't issue fines or citations like OSHA did. Mm. They can only present recommendations on how the industry and how this particular refinery might be able to improve their processes and prevent these types of incidents moving forward.
Danielle Kading with us, WPR reporter based in Superior, breaking down these newly released documents that shed light on the 2018 Husky refinery explosion and fire. Where were you? Do you remember? What questions do you have about the refinery and where it goes from here? 800-642-1234 to join in. So, Danny, what else jumped out from you in these nearly 1,300 pages of documents?
Yeah, well, one other thing that surprised the OSHA inspection team is that workers reported hearing two booms that morning before the explosion. And so workers had kind of written it off as something related to contractor work in the area, like a crane dropping a load or something like that. But the agency said there were signs that things weren't going right and felt that the shutdown should have been stopped and investigated further before moving forward with that. And there were issues with the shutdown procedure. You know, workers had only been given instructions on how to shut down this particular unit that led to the explosion just a day before the explosion. And so workers indicated that they really hadn't been properly trained other than some verbal walkthrough on that.
Yeah, and explain just a bit why a refinery is shut down. Was it being shut down for maintenance? What was this procedure it was going through?
Yeah, so the shutdown is called a turnaround. They were going through weeks of shutting down units, unit by unit, looking at them, doing inspections, and ensuring that their mechanical integrity was sound. Mm-hmm. And the refinery says this is a process that they undertake every 5 years to make sure things are operating right. But as OSHA found in their report, there were shortcomings as to how equipment was maintained.
Mm. I'm thinking about this refinery being now 72 years old, Murphy Oil owning it for the bulk of that time. But in this current decade, you've seen it change hands. It was then sold to Calumet, Calumet to Husky. Now it's Cenovus Energy, and we're going to talk more about them. But I just wonder if you have any thoughts there on how the change of hands at the refinery in recent years might affect stability of the operation.
Well, that is a very good question, Kate. And after our report went out, you know, I reached out to Cenovus and their representatives and asked, you know, are these issues that were cited by OSHA, is this something that Husky Energy was aware of when they bought the plant? Because they had bought it in November of 2017, I believe, and the explosion happened just that next spring. Mm-hmm. Cenovus didn't answer our questions, and they declined our request for interviews, and they said basically that we'll reach out to you when we want to do an interview.
Hmm. WPR's Danny Kading has been reporting on the Husky refinery explosion since that day in April 2018, recently reviewing over 1,000 pages of documents obtained by WPR from federal labor regulators. Join in on the refinery, the safety, your questions on what has changed. Maybe you live in the Twin Ports, so you have thoughts here. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Danny Kading here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing federal documents that provide a clear picture on what caused the Superior Oil Refinery explosion and fire in April 2018 that rocked the Twin Ports. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Documents obtained by WPR show that then-owner Husky Energy knew about equipment issues years before the explosion. Join in with your questions, your reflections 4 years later. 800-642-1234. WPR reporter in Superior, Danielle Kading, is with us for about 9 more minutes. So, you know, Danny, your investigation found that the refinery had rewritten its operating procedures the day before the explosion, OSHA concluding the refinery operators weren't adequately trained on these new procedures. What role did that have, and how much do you know about what operating procedures had changed?
Yeah, well, employees had indicated that this new procedure was confusing and had new and deleted steps. And OSHA found that the refinery basically didn't provide clear instructions to address the consequences of deviating from the steps in this shutdown procedure and how to correct situations like air flowing backward in the unit, which investigators believe caused the explosion. Other than that, I don't really have too many details on that aspect of it.
How many people were working at the plant in 2018?
You know, the refinery typically has around 200 full-time workers year-round. And that's expected to continue once the plant resumes normal operations.
Are they still maintaining that number of people at the plant?
Yeah. You know, right now the refinery hasn't resumed normal operations, but Husky had committed to paying its workers while the refinery was rebuilding or has been rebuilding. And so, you know, there haven't been any announcements or layoffs or cuts to workers at the Superior Refinery that I'm aware of. And there have been hundreds of contractors that have been on site rebuilding the refinery.
Okay. So what about settlements here? You know, walk us through Husky settled cases with state and federal agencies, some residents. Can you walk us through what you know about these settlements?
Sure. Yeah. OSHA reached a roughly $69,000 settlement with Husky over the violations that they uncovered as part of their investigation. And the Wisconsin Department of Justice reached a settlement with Superior Refining Company related to emissions that were given off by the explosion. And then there was also a class action settlement that was reached with residents that basically gave payments to residents for lodging when they had to evacuate the city, if they had to stay overnight in Duluth or somewhere else, and also for lost work and things like that. And then there is this ongoing case with 9 contractors who are still suing the company or Superior Refining Company, and they're seeking more than $10,000 in medical bills and lost wages. And an attorney for contractor says, you know, they've suffered PTSD, they have physical injuries that jeopardize their ability to work, and they're looking for whatever a jury thinks is fair as far as compensation.
Do you know what type of compensation local residents were able to get out of the class action suit?
I believe that class action lawsuit was for about $1 million, if I'm not mistaken. And I don't have it right in front of me, but I think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of around payments of $150 for residents located in that evacuation area.
That doesn't sound like that much compared to what we saw and what you saw on that day. Husky then is, I understand, bought out by Cenovus Energy in January of 2021. What does this change in operations mean and change in ownership?
Well, the change in ownership, I mean, now Cenovus owns the plant, but if you drive by the refinery, you know, it still has Husky's name on it. It's still Husky representatives that are working there. And You know, so I think things have been largely maintained as far as this transition for in ownership. You know, Husky, I'm sorry, Synovus has said that they're taking steps that are consistent with OSHA's recommendations for resolving some of these violations, including like looking at the condition and the operability of their equipment. They say that, you know, the refinery is being rebuilt with state-of-the-art equipment, new slide valves. You know, they've added more safety procedures related to concerns over a potential release of a highly toxic chemical known as hydrogen fluoride, which is used in their refining process. And there was never any release of that chemical that day, but that is why residents were evacuated over the potential for a release that could cause like this toxic plume that could make people sick or potentially even die.
Talking with WPR reporter Danny Kading covered the Superior Refinery since the explosion in April of 2018, the fire, the subsequent fires. You can join in your thoughts and questions, 800-642-1234. Danny, Synovus Energy, Calgary-based, second-largest Canadian oil and natural gas producer, second-largest Canadian-based refiner. How are local residents receiving the change of ownership? Are there any thoughts there?
You know, I don't know that residents have real strong feelings about the change of ownership or the purchase of the refinery. The pandemic hit the oil industry hard when everything shut down, and that kind of led to this deal and the consolidation of a lot of oil companies, especially in Canada. But, you know, I haven't heard strong feelings from residents about this deal. Labor reps have said that they think the new owner is going to be committed to worker safety.
I'm curious if you have, you know, I thought Husky was bringing in from the Bakken oil patch. And I'm wondering what Synovus Energy will be refining. Is there any sense of Synovus's plans once the refinery is totally rebuilt and operating for what its upstream will be on its Superior refinery? What will it be bringing in?
Well, you're right in that the facility processes heavy and light crude oil from Canada and North Dakota's Bakken oil fields, and it produces gasoline and diesel for the region, including asphalt, which is a byproduct of the refining process. And so my understanding is that once the refinery resumes normal operations, that they would be producing or have a refining capacity somewhere around 50,000 barrels a day. And that would be part of their overall operations in Canada and the U.S.
Just one thing that came up in April, that an environmental group launched in this elaborate hoax publicity campaign where the activists posed as Husky Energy to draw attention to the use of the, as you mentioned, the chemical hydrogen fluoride in the refining process. What did you make of this hoax?
Well, I don't know what I made of it. I don't really like to offer my opinions on it, but I think that, you know, for in the community, this hoax went largely unnoticed. Residents that I spoke with really hadn't heard much about it at all.
Just some reporter's notebook here. How difficult was it to get these nearly 1,300 pages of documents from the federal agency?
Well, if we were talking in terms of time, then I think it was very difficult. I mean, you know, and part of that, you know, there were more than 1,300 pages of documents. And so there was a lot of information that was redacted. And I'm sure that that takes time for someone to go through and redact information. But one thing we know is that OSHA really doesn't have the resources and funding to conduct inspections at every workplace nationwide. So I imagine that extends to records requests, although that's speculation on my part. But, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic also hit about a year after we filed our request, and that presented its own challenges for the agency.
What do you watch for next?
I think we're waiting to see what happens with this lawsuit from contractors and what comes of that, you know, I think that that's going to be a lengthy ongoing process. It's already been going on for years. It doesn't look like it's going to be resolved anytime soon, even though I think they have set a jury trial date for sometime next year, I believe. And also, I think what I would really like to know is if OSHA is going to conduct another inspection before this refinery starts up. They say they reserve right to do that, mm-hmm. but they haven't committed to doing that. And I think, you know, people who are concerned about whether or not things have been resolved and everything is safe want to know that the refinery is doing what they say they are doing, mm-hmm. and that they have inspected equipment beyond just what was involved in the explosion, and then they're going to make sure that workers and the surrounding community are safe.
Danny, thank you for joining us and sharing your reporting.
Thanks for having me on, Kate.
Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in the Superior Bureau. News update is next here in the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Mary Kate McCoy brings us a story about popular game show host Alan London's Wisconsin roots.
Many know TV personality Alan London for his days as the host of the popular game show Password, or for his marriage to the beloved actress Betty White. Perhaps lesser known is London's Wisconsin roots. Writer Dean Robbins recently stumbled upon his Wisconsin connection during a weekend getaway to Mineral Point.
I recently visited Mineral Point to sample its famous attractions, including the historic mining sites and the 19th century architecture. But during my stay in southwestern Wisconsin, I also stumbled onto a bit of local lore I'd known nothing about. I overheard several conversations about Alan London, the smooth-talking TV game show host of the 1960s and 70s.
Now, here's your host on Password, Alan London.
Well, thank you. Welcome to a special edition of...
And at the Red Rooster Cafe, the small town's popular breakfast spot, my placemat listed Ludden's grave as a Mineral Point highlight. Many tourists might have said, and continued visiting the art galleries on High Street, but not me. I grew up with Ludden's Password, in which contestants traded clues to guess a mystery word. As an elementary school bookworm, I was drawn to a game show host who glorified the English language. We even wore identical horn-rimmed glasses, which made him look dashingly brainy and made me look like the last one you'd pick for dodgeball. While my friends watched cowboy shows, I kept the dial tuned to Password and, no surprise, grew up to be a writer rather than a ranch hand. I'd never thought about it before, but some of the credit goes to Alan London. After a hearty breakfast at the Red Rooster, I searched the internet to explore London's Mineral Point connection. He was born there in 1917, and his father, an ice dealer, soon died of the Spanish flu. When Alan was 5, his mother married the guy who ran Mineral Point's electrical plant, after which the family moved around Wisconsin. Alan graduated Phi Beta Kappa from the University of Texas, and then earned a master's in English, suggesting that his intellectual image was not just an act. After receiving a Bronze Star in World War II, London hosted radio and television shows and found his star vehicle at Password in 1961. That's also where he met fellow TV personality Betty White.
Why, Betty White.
Why, Alan London.
Well, it's nice to see you again.
Nice to see you.
What are your plans for the summer, Miss White?
Oh, dear.
They fell deeply in love, married, and worked together on stage and screen until Alan's death from cancer in 1981. White never remarried, saying, "Once you've had the best, who needs the rest?" London was laid to rest in Mineral Point, and townsfolk speculated that his beloved Betty might be buried beside him. To their dismay, she chose not to join him for eternity in Wisconsin, though she did donate his papers to the Mineral Point Library before her own death in 2021. My Alan London journey ended with a pilgrimage to his gravesite on the western edge of town. To its credit, Graceland Cemetery gives no special treatment to Mineral Point's famous son. So, in the absence of signage, I wandered for a while through the sloping grounds. Finally, I found the tombstone, which mentions Allen's service in World War II, but nothing of his showbiz career. Indeed, the peaceful plot feels as far from his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame as you can imagine, bordered by the Iowa County Fairgrounds and rolling farmers' fields. I couldn't help thinking that Betty White might have been quite comfortable there.
Children's author and journalist Dean Robbins brought you that story about the popular game show host Alan Ludden's Wisconsin roots. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
And now we continue our conversations with Wisconsin C-Suites, companies rooted here. We focus on Oshkosh Corporation today, founded over a century ago. Nearly 15,000 employees landed that multi-billion-dollar contract with the U.S. Postal Service that was back last year. You can join in with your questions and reflections on Oshkosh Corporation, 800-642-1234. John Pfeiffer is Oshkosh Corporation's president and CEO, member of the company's board of directors, positions he's held since April of 2021. John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thank you, Kate. I'm delighted to join you this morning.
Well, take us on a whirlwind tour first, if you will. What is Oshkosh producing day to day?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll talk a little bit about our purpose, what Oshkosh is all about, because I think the why we do what we do is a little bit more interesting than the what we do, but I'll go over both very quickly. So we essentially make a difference in the lives of everyday heroes that work in our communities. I'm talking about the people in our communities that do really tough work, tough and many times dangerous work. So I'm talking about soldiers, firefighters, people who work at great height. They come into work every day. They're working 150 feet in the air. Those are the types of people that we serve. We deliver them productivity, and we deliver them safety so that when they're doing their work, they focus on what they're there to do. They don't have to worry about the equipment that they're in to do the jobs that they do. So we produce, what we do is specialty vehicles and machines that are designed to do for a specific purpose. And we've got a very strong culture around that in our company. I think all 15,000 of us really understand what we're about. We've got a great people first culture where we believe everyone comes in every day and we all make a difference in our ability to carry out that purpose that we have. We use a lot of advanced technology. We're a technology company as much as we are an industrial company. A lot of electrification work that we've been doing for 20 years, autonomous programs, intelligent products programs. So we take the technology that we have and we're capable of delivering advanced technology to continue to deliver innovations for those heroes in our communities that we're serving every day. And that's really what we're all about as a company.
Well, when you talk about electrification, you talk about, autonomous vehicles, so much of that technology has to come from somewhere, right? And I'm just wondering about all the supply chain issues that are really plaguing industries, all across the marketplace. How has Oshkosh dealt with supply chain problems?
Yeah, well, I'll be honest, the supply chain situation is pretty tough right now. You know, it's interesting when you look at our company, we've got record high order rates and really strong, probably the strongest backlogs we've ever had as a company. And that's all really good, right? Our business is growing, our customers want our products, but because supply chain is so difficult right now, it makes it more difficult to produce than it has in the recent past. In other words, in some cases, we can't get enough materials and components to produce as much as we would like to produce for our customers. or it's inconsistent in terms of what the supply is going to be. So we have to move production around depending on how material supply is coming in, and that creates inefficiencies in our operations. Essentially, any company that makes anything today is seeing these types of problems, and we're working very aggressively adding new suppliers. We've added about 400 or 500 new suppliers in the last year and a half to continue to help alleviate these problems. But we're still in a supply chain constrained environment as we sit here today. We expect that'll continue for a little bit of time.
To that point, in your annual report, you noted that amid these supply chain challenges, amid the pandemic, you shifted production to facilities with greater workforce availability.
Yeah.
What did that mean for Wisconsin?
We've done that mostly in our access equipment segment. So a lot of that work went from constrained sites in the East Coast into Midwestern sites. It did not have a whole lot of impact on the state of Wisconsin, that activity.
Talking now about the U.S. Postal Service contract selected February 2021, Oshkosh Defense getting this contract, multi-billion dollars to make and build the new electric mail trucks. Why was Oshkosh selected for the contract?
So we looked at last mile delivery. This is a last mile delivery vehicle. And we said, we think we can deliver a better solution for last mile delivery than what exists today. And that's what we do as a company. We identified last mile delivery operators, the postal carrier being the predominant operator. The Postal Service is the biggest last mile delivery company in the United States, perhaps the world. And we said we can deliver a better purpose-built solution than what is being used today. So we designed and developed a vehicle that the last mile delivery industry has never seen before. It delivers incredible improvements in productivity. It delivers incredible improvements in safety for the mail carrier, as well as for people that are around the vehicle. Remember, these vehicles go by every single home in America 6 days a week. And we designed it to be extremely safe for anyone around that vehicle. So it was great innovations right in line with what we do to deliver that everyday hero, the postal carrier in this case, something better than they've ever conceived of having. And I think that's why we won the program. Of course, we used a lot of advanced technology. Electrification is only one of the technological advancements on that vehicle. That certainly helped, but I think that's essentially probably why we won the program.
Vehicles will be built in South Carolina, not Wisconsin. That was right. A point of friction here in Wisconsin. What led to the decision not to make them here?
Yeah, well, what we have to do when we decide where we're going to produce a product is do what will help us be the most successful for our customer, in this case, the United States Postal Service. And so we did consider Wisconsin. For sure, we considered Wisconsin. We worked with the Milwaukee 7. We went all over the state to determine if this was a suitable place to produce. We also went down to the Southeast and other Midwestern areas. And when we look at something like that, we look at, in this case, about a dozen different criteria that we look at objectively. There are things like proximity to the supply chain, which is really important in this type of a program because it's much more high volume than our typical program. And being close to the supply chain makes a big difference in overall efficiency. So there's about 10 or 12 criteria we look at. We looked at it objectively, we scored it, and South Carolina came out to be the most optimal place for us to be as effective as we possibly can be for the United States Postal Service. But we certainly included sites in Wisconsin or potential locations in Wisconsin. We just had to make an objective decision, and South Carolina's where we ended up. But I will say, we developed this technology in the state of Wisconsin. We're hiring a lot of people in terms of engineers to continue to develop more advanced electrification technologies as we go forward. So we're talking about hundreds of high-paying jobs that will be located and new jobs in the state of Wisconsin that are directly related to this program.
Ballpark, how many related to this program?
Oh, over 100. That'll be in the state of Wisconsin. Yeah.
A little bit of a postmortem lessons learned here. What could Wisconsin do to make itself more attractive, more suited to have secured, you know, the mail truck assembly line here? What can Wisconsin learn from this moment?
Well, first of all, I want to say, you know, we do a lot of investing in the state of Wisconsin. I mean, it's where most of our, if you look at us as a corporation, we're a big global company. We got 150 locations around the world. We have more investment in the state of Wisconsin than any other place. Wisconsin is a great place to be. It is a great place to manufacture, and it's a great place to develop technology. No question. We're making investments in our defense operations. We just put a $1 billion program into one of our core defense plants that's going to continue to help us grow that business. We're expanding our Pierce operations up in Appleton, Wisconsin. That's going to add another 200 people to that operation in Wisconsin. So Wisconsin's a great place to be. This is when you think about the U.S. Postal Service, this is a new last mile delivery program for us. It is high volume, a program that when you look at it, we have to really look at again, where are our partners and supply chain partners for this program and where is it most optimal for us to produce? So, you know, one program works best in the state of Wisconsin, another program might work best in another state. I'm not sure there's anything specific that we would say Wisconsin needs to do better. We're going to continue to grow our business in Wisconsin just like we're growing it in other places in the world.
Oshkosh Corporation CEO John Pfeiffer with us, stays with us. Join in on the business of vehicle production, on these contract sustainability questions. What's on your mind about Oshkosh business practices? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with John Pfeiffer here on the Ideas Network. We're in conversation with Wisconsin executives on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Oshkosh Corporation today that spelled out the health of the company in its 2021 annual report, saying they concluded the year with optimism, delivering double-digit growth in revenue, operating income, and earnings per share while securing record backlogs. Join in on business climate, nature of the industry, what you want to know about what Oshkosh makes. 800-642-1234. CEO John Pfeiffer with us for about 7 more minutes. Let's bring in Jack in Caledonia. Jack, hi. What's on your mind?
Hey, just with the electric cars that are used for the Postal Service, knowing a few of the postmen that drive them, their situation is that when they load up in the morning, they have to return back to the office or back to the garage to get another car, because after 4 hours the battery is depleted. And I thought electric cars last, you know, for 200 some miles, and they said no, it's just how long the battery is running. That kind of confused me a little bit.
Jack, thank you for that question. John, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. First of all, there's not any electric vehicles that I know of in the postal fleet today. We don't start delivering vehicles until 2023. And so if there is an electric vehicle, then I don't know who supplied it, but it wouldn't be from us. You know, when you look at the postal vehicles today, a couple of things. One I'll mention is that they were designed 35, 40 years ago. So they were designed for mostly letter delivery. And what we all know is happening, of course, is now postal vehicles are delivering e-commerce packages. So they need more cargo space, which is one of the reasons why they're having to return to the post office mid-shift, because the current vehicles aren't big enough. We've designed a vehicle that gives them a lot more productivity and space to deliver e-commerce packages. But on the electrification front, you mentioned there a potential need to recharge during the route. We've designed the vehicle so that for the most part does not need to happen. And you have to remember the postal vehicle is a very unique fleet of vehicles. It's the only fleet of vehicles that there is that delivers to every single residence in America 6 days a week. No other last mile delivery fleet does that. So it's a big fleet of vehicles, but the average route that a postal carrier will go on is somewhere around 15 miles. And so our ability to deliver the range that they need on the full shift is very feasible. We do not expect any recharging mid-shift to happen with our vehicles. And you'll start seeing them in communities towards the end of 2023. We go into production in 2023, and you'll start seeing them in communities later in the year.
Well, broadening this out for a moment, the next generation of everything hinges on battery power, battery life. Oshkosh has been investing in lithium-ion battery maker Microvast. Are you worried about battery shortages, about the life cycle of battery systems as you look at the inputs needed for next-gen vehicles?
We worry mostly about battery shortages. Now, we work very closely with several really strong lithium ion battery manufacturers, some like Microvast we've made investments in, and we pay very close attention with those partners. You know, we create partnerships with them on how we're securing the supply chain going forward, because we all see, you know, one of the great things that's happened is lithium ion battery costs have come down by 90% over the last 10 years. So that's really good. What that means is we can make it much more feasible to put electric vehicles into the marketplace. It's one of the reasons we're seeing so much growth in electrification for a lot of vehicles that we all use and see today. But as those vehicles continue to grow, that's going to put pressure on the supply chain. So we're very conscious of that. We work very hard with our suppliers to secure the supply chain to make sure that we can deliver for our customers. And the one we're talking about right now is the Postal Service, but we also have a lot of other fire station. We've done an electric fire truck. We've done electric airport rescue vehicle. We've done electric construction equipment. We've done electrification essentially across our portfolio. So we all of us in industry have to pay attention to the supply chain of lithium ion and lithium ion batteries.
Only a few moments left. I just want to get a few words from you on the great reshuffle, the great resignation, and the churn we're seeing in companies. How are you addressing turnover?
Yeah, I think the turnover situation certainly is, we could say the shortage of people, and it's everywhere, right? It's in manufacturing, it's in engineering, it's in sales and marketing. It's really across the board where we're seeing a shortage of people to do all the work that we have. So we try to differentiate ourselves as an employer of choice. You know, we've got strong wages and benefits for our people. We've got great benefit programs that go not just in health, but in many, many facets of people's lives, where we think that gives us an advantage. And we've got incredible people. We continue to need to recruit people, but we also think our purpose helps a lot. Our purpose is so tangible and it's so real. You know, we're working to help people in our communities who are doing the toughest jobs. People like working in an organization that has that palpable of a purpose.
Well, John,
that gives
we
us
have
a little
to,
bit of an edge too.
We have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us.
Okay. Thank you, Kate.
John Pfeiffer, CEO of Oshkosh Corporation on the Ideas Network.